Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
The search for life in our universe gets a big boost. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Are we alone in the universe? Scientists have been trying to answer this simple question that has a complex answer for generations. We'll speak with SETI Institute's Bill Diamond about a recent donation that was made to his organization that will help better answer that age-old question. Then, what's hidden inside planets? We'll speak with planetary scientist and author Sabina Stanley about what goes on inside the cores of planets and what we can learn from them. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? For almost 40 years, the SETI Institute has been pushing the boundaries of human knowledge in exploring life beyond our planet and the origins of life here on Earth. Recently, it has received a $200 million donation that will help propel those efforts. Here to talk about SETI's work and what's ahead is Bill Diamond, president and CEO of the SETI Institute. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brendan. Great to be here.
Yeah, super excited to have you on, Bill. And I know you are all very excited about some recent funding. Tell us a bit about this donation you received and how it's going to help the efforts at the SETI Institute.
Sure. Delighted to. We have thankfully been the beneficiary of an extraordinary gift from a gentleman named Franklin Antonio, who is one of the co-founders of the chip company Qualcomm. And we all know Qualcomm, whether we realize it or not, because their chips are in all our mobile phones and portable devices. But Franklin was an extraordinarily gifted technologist and electrical engineer, and he had been supporting SETI programs at the SETI Institute. What was interesting about Franklin was not only was he providing the funds to the Institute to support these programs, he was actually a member of the team. He came to our weekly engineering and technical meetings, provided his knowledge and vast experience in communications technology, and in fact, tried to remind us that the problem we were trying to solve or the search we were undertaking was less about astronomy and astrophysics and more about communications technology. So it was he was an extraordinary man, and you know, we were blessed to have him not only, again, supporting us, but actively engaged and coaching the team. And quite unexpectedly, he passed away last year. And unbeknownst to us, he had included the Institute in his estate plans. And that resulted in an extraordinary gift of $200 million being given to the Institute. And he did not specify any particular purpose. He did not indicate that it was for endowment or SETI programs or anything else, completely unrestricted. And of course, such a large gift enables a great deal. Our plan is not to actually spend the capital, but to treat the gift as though it was an endowment and to take distributions each year based on the change in value of the investments. Even those distributions are significant. They'll be, you know, between $6 and $12 million a year in all probability. They will help permanently endow SETI endeavors, which do not enjoy access to federally funded grants or research funds. We will even make available to the global community doing SETI research a pool of funds for researchers to apply to for technology development, experimentation, et cetera. We also plan on helping to leverage our existing STEM education programs with these funds to expand those, including internationally, and try and have as much impact with this gift as we possibly can.
I work for a nonprofit, Bill, an additional $6 to $12 million a year. I know what I would do with that. And it would be absolutely transformative to my organization. Is this endowment expanding what SETI does, or is it going to be something that is transformative that is going to help you get closer to answering that very simple question with a very complex answer? Are we alone in the universe?
I would say that the gift does not change our core mission. So it's not heading us in any different direction, but it certainly facilitates and enables that mission. It does allow us to deploy more resources against that mission. First of all, if we take the core activity, if you will, our namesake activity of SETI research using radio and optical telescopes to search for signs of technology as a proxy for life and intelligence in the universe. You know, just funding that on an ongoing basis where we don't have to raise money every year to do that and find donors and other support to make that possible, that is transformative in its own right. Being able to invest some of those funds in furthering the technology we use, building newer and more advanced feeds for the Allen Telescope Array, building new compute backends for signal processing and data analytics, investing in programs like COSMIC on the Very Large Array, which is perhaps one of the most transformative SETI programs in history. These are things that I think the gift will enable. I also believe that while funding things like postdoctoral researchers is maybe not transformative as launching a spacecraft might be, nevertheless, it's hugely important to us and I think so impactful for the science to provide funding to the next generation of researchers in the various domains of science we undertake at the Institute and to have those individuals be part of our community, bringing their own research ideas. We do have bolder plans in mind with these funds that include developing our own space missions. These would be done, of course, in partnership with others. We don't have launch capability at the Institute, but we do have the ability to design and develop instrumentation and payloads for spacecraft. So looking for partnerships and projects that we have in mind along the lines of astrobiology projects, for example, these are things that I think will be also enabled by this gift that one could put the label, you know, transformative or hugely impactful because they're bigger and bolder than just sort of incremental spending.
What are some gaps that you're hoping to fill with kind of more space-based missions? I find that quite fascinating that SETI's trying to leave the planet.
Well, I mean, you know, our work takes us to, further out than most other organizations. We're not confined to our own solar system, for example, as most spacecraft missions are. So, you know, we can interrogate the far reaches of the galaxy or even beyond. But in terms of spacecraft, one of the mission ideas that we're particularly excited about is actually looking back at planet Earth with a suite of instruments, spectrographic, hyperspectrographic, image-based, from an appropriate distance where the entire planet fills the field of view of the instrumentation and allows us to observe phenomena on our planet at planetary scale. So it's essentially looking at Earth as an astrobiologist from another world would. And since we know the Earth has both biosignatures and technosignatures, evidence of life and evidence of technology in its atmosphere, on its surface, et cetera, then, you know, we have a known case study where we can say, well, what does such a world look like when studied from, you know, an array of instrumentation of the kind we also can deploy in space? Mm-hmm. And I think this can also be very helpful and transformative in these conversations that are more about our place on Earth than others in space.
Bill, if my math is right, the SETI Institute's coming up on 40 years of operation.
Absolutely. In fact, today marks the beginning of our 40th year. So next November 20th will be our 40th anniversary. So we're sort of embarked on our 40th year of operations and activities. So it's kind of a landmark moment. So quite serendipitous that Franklin's gift should come at this moment.
So with that, with 4 decades of searching the skies, are we any, and I say we collectively, I'm not doing this work, are you all any closer to answering that question? You know, are we alone in the universe? And could you and I get an answer to that question in our lifetime?
Well, perhaps you have a better chance than I do, since I'm quite a bit older, but I honestly do. First of all, I think that one of the most profound things in terms of new knowledge that we have gained over the past 40 years is the knowledge that when we look up in the sky on a starry night, we're not actually looking at stars, which is what we can see with our naked eye or even our telescopes, but we're looking at solar systems. So we now know, thanks to NASA's Kepler mission, that, you know, exoplanets are everywhere and that, statistically speaking, every star in the sky has one or more planets around it. We also know from that same mission that roughly 20% of those worlds are rocky, Earth-like in terms of size and configuration, and in the so-called habitable zone of their host star, where potentially the conditions would be right to support liquid water. And that number translates to sort of tens of billions of potentially habitable environments. And this is now, you know, an accepted scientific fact, which when the Institute began, we had no idea whether, you know, planets were rare or common, whether our solar system was the only one of its kind. It seemed unlikely, but nevertheless, we had no evidence. So I think that's been a profound step. I would say as well that in terms of being closer to a discovery, first of all, now, thanks to this knowledge of exoplanets, we have specific places to point our telescopes or our other instruments, because we can do now targeted searches, and we can use different types of phenomena where, you know, we might be better or more likely to observe some sort of communication or some sort of technical phenomena that would certainly indicate definitively the presence of intelligent life beyond our planet. You know, as we learn more on our own technology advances, we develop more tools and capabilities and more modalities of how to look and where to look and what instrumentation to use. So I do think we're getting closer. And of course, even with missions within our own solar system, such as the Perseverance mission to Mars, we're looking for evidence of even very basic life. Finding evidence of that elsewhere in our own solar system would be profound for what it would imply. It would imply that, you know, life is perhaps an emergent process that's going to happen everywhere it possibly can. So yes, I think we're getting ever closer. And I like to say that statistically speaking, I think the chances that we're alone in the universe are basically zero.
And I know all of that, right? I know the numbers. I know the numbers. I'm fascinated by the exoplanet discoveries. It's so cool. But it's still like, it's almost unbelievable to think that we may be able to say that we have found a sign of life outside of our planet. And I don't know if a lot of people would believe that. What is the plan to communicate these findings when you do find them and get the general public to actually believe something that is certainly one of the greatest discoveries of our generation?
So that's a great question. And in fact, the frequency of that question seems to be going up as we feel collectively that we're getting closer to that discovery. So it is an important question. Needless to say, part of the communication plan depends greatly on the nature of the discovery. You know, while a discovery of, say, organic life on a place like Mars, say, cyanobacteria somewhere below the surface of the planet would be extraordinary. Nevertheless, I think that would perhaps garner less attention from the public than, say, the discovery of a technosignature as evidence of intelligent and technical life beyond our planet. So in the latter case, if we were to find this kind of evidence, I think the first thing we would be doing as a scientific organization or as a scientific community, such a discovery could be made by some other organization, it would be to verify, to say, you know, it looks like we have something interesting. Now we call upon, you know, the scientific community, whether that's radio astronomers or regular astronomers or astrobiologists, to, you know, tune your instruments to this location and see if we can verify and validate what we believe we have discovered. If the discovery can be validated, you know, sufficiently to make a public announcement, you know, we would do so. And I think this would be in the form of probably a press release, press conference. It's the sort of thing where I think we have to be very careful about calling press conferences. I've always said that if the SETI Institute calls a press conference, you know, everybody's going to show up. So we'd better have something important and verifiable to say. But there is growing interest in, you know, the public response to such a discovery and such an announcement. And in fact, one of the other things we're doing with the funds from Franklin and Antonio is to establish a post-detection working group within the Institute to start thinking about the implications, you know, societal implications, technical, scientific, economic, you know, religious, philosophical, et cetera. You know, what's going to happen when such an announcement is made? You know, how will the public respond, you know, and how might we prepare for that, both in terms of how we communicate it and so forth?
I just have to chuckle and thinking of the greatest discovery of humankind. We'll find out in a press release. Well, I look forward to that announcement, Bill, and I'm excited to hear that you are getting closer and closer to being able to make that announcement. Bill Diamond is the president and CEO of the SETI Institute. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brendan. Been a pleasure.
Still to come.
The reason that Earth is such a lovely place to exist for humans on the surface is because of the processes going on deep inside.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. You shouldn't judge a book by its cover. or a podcast for its cover art, and perhaps that's true for planets too. Is planetary beauty only skin deep, and what can we learn from the core of planets? Well, planetary scientist and author Sabina Stanley's new book, What's Hidden Inside Planets, tackles some of those questions, and she joins us now to crack the surface of that topic. Sabina, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
So the book is called What's Hidden Inside Planets. And this is actually a very fascinating topic, especially with some missions that are happening right now. We'll get into that in a bit. But first, let's talk about how you got excited about the interior of planets, because from the outside, doesn't seem like a very exciting field of planetary sciences to get into. But it is, in fact, right? What drew you to the core of planets?
Yeah, I like to think of it as, imagine that you got this really nicely wrapped present and you wanted to figure out what's inside. And so there are all sorts of cool ways you can figure it out, right? You can shake the box, you can try and listen to it, you can weigh it. And it's the same sort of thing when we're trying to understand what's going on inside planets. We have to come up with clever methods to figure out what's going on inside. Now imagine that you also learned that the reason the present looks so pretty on the outside is because of what's inside. Then you really want to know what's going on inside the planet, because it's responsible for this beautiful thing on the surface. So same with planets. The reason that Earth is such a lovely place to exist for humans on the surface is because of the processes going on deep inside.
I'm going to assume that you don't actually shake planets to figure out what's inside them, right? That'd be nice, right? What can you actually do to uncover what is at the core of what's happening on a planetary body?
Yeah, so fun story. Sometimes we do shake planets, or maybe if it's not us, then something else shakes a planet. So whenever you have an impact on the surface of a planet, that creates quakes that go through waves that go through the planet. So for example, on Earth, we have earthquakes that can create waves that go through the Earth. Those waves travel at different speeds depending on the material they're in. And then we record them with seismometers around the surface of the planet. So that actually allows us to use the shaking of the planet to figure out what goes on inside. But there are other things we can do too. So for example, gravity. If you measure the gravity field of Earth, you know, people talk, they think about gravity as being this constant thing on the surface of the Earth, maybe like 9.8 meters per second squared. But in reality, gravity changes as you're walking on the surface, and it's because of the amount of material below your feet. And so we can use really sensitive measures of the gravity field to figure out the composition and the structure deep inside the Earth. We can also use magnetic fields. So in Earth, for example, the liquid iron in our core generates a dynamo, which generates a magnetic field that then we can study at the surface. So we can investigate the changes that are happening in our magnetic field to actually kind of trace out as like a predictor or a probe of what's going on very deep inside the Earth. And that's true for other planets as well.
What is at the core of our planet, and how does that influence what we see at the surface? And then maybe that'll give me a better understanding of how you do this for other planets.
Yeah, great question. So long ago, when the Earth was forming, it formed in such a way that there was enough heat trapped inside the planet that it was molten. And all of the heaviest stuff, things like iron, for example, descended to the center of the core. So the center of the Earth has our heaviest materials like iron and nickel and those sorts of things. So the Earth, for example, is about half in radius, half iron, and then half a rocky layer that we're kind of used to experiencing in the crust here on the surface. So that's how the Earth is structured. And most of the other planets have a structure kind of like that. The heaviest stuff is at the center. That might be iron, like in the rocky planets like Mercury and Venus and Mars. They also have these iron cores and then these rocky mantles. But in the outer solar system, you actually get even stranger materials inside planets because you've got new building blocks for planets. So for example, in Jupiter and Saturn, most of the outsides is hydrogen and helium. But then deep inside again, you've got these rocks and ices all mixed in to create their cores.
One of the interesting missions that's happening that we talked about recently on this show is the Psyche mission, right? It's off to this asteroid to look at its core, because that may give us some insight into how some of our planet was formed. Tell us a bit about the science you're expecting to come back from Psyche, and that how that will help you better understand the cores of other planets.
So 16 Psyche is a metal asteroid, and it's really sort of a different kind of world than we've explored before. We've explored rocky worlds, we've explored water worlds, we've explored gas worlds, but we've never explored a metal world. So Psyche, we think, is kind of the leftover bit of a slightly larger body where the rocky part was knocked off. So it's really an exposed core. And it turns out on Earth, if we wanted to go study our core up close, that's really hard because you have to dig through 2,000 miles of rock. And that's impossible. So Psyche allows us the opportunity to to get up close and really see the core and measure it, all of its properties and stuff, really close up. So I think we're going to learn a lot about our own core being able to study this exposed core of a building block of planets.
In the book, you mentioned Venus is an annoying planet. I'd like for you to state your case, and then we'll reach out to Venus for comment. But why is Venus such an annoying planet?
Venus is the worst, okay? I'm just going to put that out there. If you are a planetary scientist and you want to try to understand what goes on inside planets, all of these really clever methods that planetary scientists have developed that work for all the other planets don't work at Venus. So Venus just does not want us to study it. It's very frustrating. So I'll give you a couple examples. One way that we can actually figure out what's happening inside a planet is from a planet's rotation. So when a planet rotates, it actually bulges at the center. And that the size of that bulge is determined by the structure inside. So how much of an iron core you have, for example, versus a rocky layer. And so, great, we can learn a lot about the interior of the Earth and other planets by looking at their bulge. You get to Venus, and Venus rotates so slowly that there's no bulge. So we can't use that method. So then you're like, okay, maybe I want to use seismology on Venus to study Venus, right? Again, the waves traveling through the planet can tell you about the composition in the interior. Unfortunately, if you try to land a seismometer on the surface of Venus, it's so hostile down there, the temperatures are excruciatingly hot, the atmosphere is corrosive, that nothing could survive on the surface. So no instrumentation on the surface, sorry about that. Then you're like, okay, maybe we can look at the magnetic field, right? On Earth, the magnetic field's generated in the core, we can observe it at the surface. Unfortunately, Venus does not have a magnetic field, so we can't use magnetic fields either to study the interior of Venus. So Venus is just, it does not cooperate at all with planets, and I would love to hear comments from Venus about why that is.
Is that just a limit to our technology, and will there eventually be a time when we're able to get some surface probes down there or be able to make these observations, or will Venus never open up to us? Is that what we're doomed to?
I think our technology is improving and we are making some progress in this. And I think some of the upcoming missions that are planned to Venus, even though they're not going to land on the surface, even just studying the atmosphere of Venus and things like the gravity field of Venus, we might be able to learn some things, but it's just very frustrating.
Well, we'll reach out to Venus to see what we can find out.
Thank you.
So this research and this way that you approach understanding planetary bodies, is that just limited to what we have in the solar system, or are you able to apply these methods to look at exoplanets, planets that exist outside of our solar system?
Absolutely. Not the same methods, but we can use other methods to study what's going on in exoplanets. So for example, nowadays with different techniques, we can figure out the mass and the radius of different exoplanets, and that can tell us its density, whether you've got a rocky planet or a gas planet, things like that. But with the JWST telescope that's currently observing exoplanets, as well as a bunch of other things out there, we are going to get, it's just going to completely change the quality of information we get from exoplanets. We're going to be able to tell what their atmospheres are made of. And that's incredibly important because knowing if something, for example, has certain elements in its atmosphere can tell you a lot about what's going on inside the planet, right? Our atmosphere is, first of all, a product of the life on the surface of the Earth, right? But also what gets outgassed from the center of the planet. So we're really excited for new results coming from JWST about exoplanets' atmospheres, because that's going to tell us a lot about the interior too.
And I know a lot of this research with JWST and looking at exoplanets is to find planets that may have the possibility of life or be able to be habitable planets. Is the stuff that you learn about its core, does that relate to that habitability in the search for life outside of our solar system?
Yeah, it would be really great if we could determine which exoplanets have magnetic fields, because those magnetic fields shield the planet from high energy particles that come from their parent star.
Much like our planet, right?
Exactly. So one of the reasons Earth is such a nice place to live is because we are not bombarded by radiation from the solar wind and from cosmic rays. And that's because of our magnetic field. So we don't know for sure if magnetic fields are absolutely necessary for life to form, but it definitely helps. So I think it would, you know, kind of in that list of items that you would like for a planet in order to generate life, having a magnetic field is one of them. So it'd be great if you determine that a planet has a core, that's the first step in making sure that you have a magnetic field. But also there are new techniques coming on to try and actually measure the magnetic fields of exoplanets. So that's another area of research.
Understanding the core of the planet, you understand its formation, you understand what the environment is like, but can the core also tell you what might happen to the planet towards the end of its life?
Ooh, great question. So, you know, when you think of stars, for example, stars they end their lives like in very dramatic fashion, right? They're total drama queens, right? They either have a huge supernova explosion or they become a black hole, right? Planets are much quieter, they're more calm. And so you can kind of ask, when would we decide that a planet has ended its life? And maybe one definition that I'll put forward is maybe when it stops having any activity, any processes happening in its interior. And that's all related to how planets remove their heat. So when will a planet run out of heat? So if you think about the Earth, you can look at, for example, how much heat is stored in the core and the mantle of the planet, and how much heat is being generated by radioactive elements in the core and the mantle. And you can ask, when are those going to run out? And, you know, you do a quick calculation of that. We don't know for sure, but you're talking about something like 50 billion years from now. So it's going to be a long time before planet Earth dies that way. Unfortunately for Earth, our sun, our star, is going to die before the planet does. But in that death phase, we're going to go through what's called a red giant phase, and the sun's going to expand and is going to envelop the Earth and probably destroy it at that time. So in about 5 billion years, that's going to happen. So the Earth isn't going to see its own destruction. It's going to be destroyed by the sun.
I like how you're just throwing shade. Venus is annoying. Stars are drama queens. Just, it's fantastic. Just, yes. So finally, Sabina, this is a fascinating field of science, and I'm so glad you're sharing it with me. And the book really does a great job at pardon the pun, digging deep into this field. But, you know, over the next maybe 5 years or decade, what are you most excited for when it comes to advances in studying the cores of planets?
Oh, yeah. Great question. A couple of things. So first of all, we have this great mission that's planned to go to an incredible moon in the outer solar system named Titan. So it's a moon of Saturn. And the mission's called Dragonfly. And it's going to go to Titan and land on the surface, do a bunch of data collection, and then fly again to another point, land, do a bunch of data collections. It's a really great mission. But the amazing thing about Titan is that it's the only other body in the solar system that has a nitrogen-based thick atmosphere. So Earth is the other one, right? So it's got a lot of similarities to Earth. It's also got liquids flowing on the surface, just like Earth does. The liquids on Titan are methane and ethane, hydrocarbons like that. So it's not as kind of, you don't want to go swimming in that stuff. But still, it's got a lot of the processes that Earth does. So understanding how the interior of Titan produces all that stuff we see on the surface, I think would be really great. You know, we last explored Uranus and Neptune in the 1980s with one mission, Voyager 2, flew by the planets very quickly. They're still out there functioning, exploring the boundary between our solar system and other space. And we need to go back there and check out those planets again, because there's lots of cool questions that we need to answer about ice giants like Uranus and Neptune.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for joining us. Sabina Stanley is a Bloomberg Distinguished Professor of Planetary Physics at Johns Hopkins University. The book is What's Hidden Inside Planets. It's out now. Thank you so much for this fascinating conversation about the insides of planets.
Thanks so much. This was fun.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit WMFE.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marian Summerall. Our intern is Alessandro Boniuto. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.